Have you ever wanted to learn where you can get free food and medicine from the plants growing around your neighborhood? Or how to turn your own backyard into a food production center? Or even how to reverse cancers using the latest groundbreaking research in alternative cancer therapies? You can learn all this and more from webseed.com. It's sort of like Netflix, but it's for documentaries and how-to courses on natural health, food production, self-reliance, and other life-saving topics. I'm Mike Adams, the Health Ranger, and I created WebSeed so that listeners like you could get instant streaming access to truly groundbreaking instructional courses. Our new program called Vaccines Armed and Dangerous exposes the total fraud of modern vaccine quackery, and our Survival course teaches emergency preparedness, including skills like how to build your own emergency water filter. Explore over 100 valuable courses and documentaries right now at WEBSEED.com.
Heart-related health problems affect millions of people each year. Maybe you're one of the many who suffer from issues related to angina pain, high blood pressure, congestive heart failure, unbalanced cholesterol, irregular heartbeat, or clogged arteries. There is a solution that doesn't involve expensive prescription drugs that only mask the problem and leave you with horrible side effects. If you are ready to live your life free of sickness, pain, and fear, live your life with increased vitality, energy, and youthfulness, and experience your body healing itself, then you're ready for Heart and Body Extract from Healthy Hearts Club. Heart and Body Extract has a 23-year proven track record of using certified organic herbs that make up an excellent formula to balance and support the heart and circulatory system. In as little as 2 weeks, you can feel amazing results when your 2-month supply of Heart and Body Extract today. Call 1-866-295-5305 or go to hbextract.com.
Do you know someone who can benefit from this radio program? You can find the complete archives of this show and hundreds of others at naturalnewsradio.com. Just send your friend that link, naturalnewsradio.com, where they will find truly amazing interviews and information that simply isn't published anywhere else. In the Natural News Radio archives, you'll find interviews with Dr. Andrew Wakefield, Senator Rand Paul, Governor Jesse Ventura, Suzanne Summers, alternative cancer doctors, nutrition experts, preparedness experts, and a wealth of others. And it's all free. Listen in real time at naturalnewsradio.com or download the MP3 archive files anytime you want to listen on your phone, mobile devices, or personal computer. When you want articles on these topics, check out naturalnews.com with over 35,000 article pages on nutrition, natural cures, health freedom, and much more. It's all part of the Natural News Network. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, welcome to Survival and Beyond. I'm your host, Ed Corcoran, and we're broadcasting on Natural News Radio and the Prepper Podcast Radio Network. And we're going to start off with, I've got some big news here. Some of it you are aware of, and some of it, this particular piece of information, you're not going to be aware of. As you well know, the tensions are increasing between Israel and Iran, which is pretty much a giant freaking joke, considering that the media is focusing all of its attention on Iran, and it's a tragic joke. I say it's a joke. It's a killing joke. It's not a joke at all. I mean that in the most ironic way possible, the most sarcastic way possible. This is a freaking travesty. Okay, all right. First of all, are you going to get fooled by the weapons of mass destruction lie again? Are you going to buy this rhetoric? Are you going to buy into this like you did with Iraq? Because that's exactly what the media and what the government is trying to do to you. They're trying to make a dupe out of you again. And you're going to send your kids off to another war, yet another war, by our Peace Prize president, Barack Hussein Obama, is going to get us involved in this. And, you know, and this is going to tie into my whole philosophy and my recommendation, my new recommendation. I'm going to get to that in a minute because right now this is too important. First of all, the reason why this is such a just an insane affront to logic and to thinking, feeling, rational human beings, no matter what country you live in, okay? The state of Israel is a terrorist state, okay? You know, for those of you, I know there's a lot of you out there who say, we're going to stand by Israel, we're going to support Israel, we're going to, you know, why, you know? Israel's our only friend in the Middle East. And it's like, well, until there was Israel, we didn't have any enemies in the Middle East. And you know, and this is also tying in with all of the protests and the violence that's going on at all the embassies and all that's going on. And the media wants you to believe that all of these people are freaking out that, first of all, it's not against America. No, it's not against America. Is that why they're burning all the American flags? Is it because they couldn't find another flag to burn? And the second thing is they're all freaking out over a freaking poorly made B-rate video that's been seen by about 5,000 people on YouTube. That's, if you're not familiar with how many people that is on a global scale, that's almost nobody. Almost nobody has, it's obscure. I'm sure a lot more people have seen it now since it's made the news and everything like that. But if you think these people are freaking out and they hate America because of this movie, and I hesitate to call it a movie because it's just, it's so badly made, then you deserve to be duped if you're that stupid. If you believe that you know, they're freaking out over a movie. No, they're not freaking out over a movie. They're freaking out because we bombed the crap out of them because of our foreign policy. They don't hate us for our freedom. They don't hate us because you know, we're Christians or we're a Christian country. They hate us because we send drones over there that murder their people. Yeah. Let that sink in. We murder their children, okay? 90% of the people who die from drone attacks are civilians and children. That's your war on terror, okay, folks? This is your drone program. And hey, and then guess what? They're going to be doing it here too because we got 30,000 drones in the United States and this program is already rolling. There's already drones flying over America. And for all you apologists and all you namby-pamby sheeple out there, and I know my listeners aren't among them, but hey, maybe some sheeple have drifted in and decided to listen to my show out of curiosity. If you just happen to come across this and you're freaking half asleep and this is all news to you, well, guess what? These you people who say, well, they promise that they're not going to arm the drones. They promise that they're not ever going to put weapons on them. They're only going to use them for surveillance. So what? They shouldn't be surveilling us. This is America. We shouldn't have flying robots crisscrossing our skies, going across through the chemtrails and taking pictures of us over our house. Okay? You know, Judge Andrew Napolitano said the first person who shoots down a drone over their house is going to be an American folk hero. You know what? I agree with them. And I say that if you see a drone and you have the means to take it down, then that's exactly what you should do because this is unconstitutional. We do not live in Stasi Nazi Germany, okay? We don't acquiesce and surrender and knuckle under to a surveillance state, which is what we're in right now. If you don't believe it, then you haven't been paying attention. But getting back to the Israeli-Iran thing, we're looking at World War III, ladies and gentlemen, and if you don't believe that, then, again, you need to wake up. And the thing that's so comical about this, which is so tragically comical about this, is that Iran has cooperated at every turn to IAEA demands, the International Atomic Energy Association, right? Now, dig this. The Washington's chief nuclear arms negotiator, Rose Gottmuller, asked Israel to sign the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. Israel refused. The United Nations passed a resolution calling on Israel to sign the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and to submit to inspections. Israel refused to do that. The IAEA asked Israel to sign the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and to submit to inspections, and they refused that as well, right? At every turn, Israel has refused to be inspected, to have their facilities inspected. You don't think that they have nuclear weapons? They've got nuclear weapons, and guess what? They've been selling them to other countries as well. They tried to sell nuclear weapons to South Africa. And who knows who else they've approached to sell their weapons. However, on the other hand, Iran has always acquiesced to all of the IAEA demands. The United States intelligence agencies and the International Atomic Energy Administration are unanimous. They're unanimous in agreement that Iran is not developing nuclear weapons. They're enriching uranium. They have a right to produce their own energy and to have nuclear power plants. And yeah, their enrichment facilities are underground because they know that if they left them on the surface, then they get bombed, just like the ones in Iraq. You know, and yeah, back in 2003, 2004, Israel was claiming that Iraq had nuclear weapons. Well, and they bombed their facilities, and it turns out that when they sifted through the wreckage, there was no sign of any kind of nuclear facility, no nuclear weapons whatsoever, you know? So this is the whole carrot and stick routine. You're going to send your kids off to another war to fight an imaginary ghost of a threat that does not exist, all in support of the nation, the state of Israel. You know what? They don't deserve our backing, our help, our respect. Hell, they stole uranium from us back in 1965, Israel did. And, you know, on top of that, the United Nations, the body that was mainly responsible for creating the State of Israel itself, has released a Goldstone report, which accuses Israel of 37 crimes against humanity in Gaza. But, you know, of course, Israel claims that the report is anti-Semitic, even though Goldstone, the judge who wrote the report, is Jewish himself, you know, and the United States is blocking the report from being referred to as a war crimes tribunal. The state of Israel has been guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity for almost as long as it's existed. But hey, you know, you want to go and fly in a battle in support of Israel? You want your kids to die for these criminals, these terrorists? And it's going to happen. It's already starting. This is the piece of news I alluded to earlier in the show. I heard this. I got this from Nurse Amy Alton, who, with her husband Joe, Dr. Bones. They do Dr. Bones and the Doom and Bloom here on Natural News. And they were at a survival expo, and there was an Israeli soldier at their booth, and they were talking to him, and he got a phone call, and he suddenly had to leave. He had to leave right away, and he said that he had gotten a call from his commanding officer. They were recalling him back to Israel because they're getting ready to bomb Iran. So from the words of an Israeli soldier himself, this is happening. This is happening, folks. And you're going to have to decide if you want to support Israel in this foundless war against Iran. There's absolutely no evidence that they don't pose any threat to us. We've been screwing with Iran, with their government, with their society since 1952. Ever since we sent Roosevelt over there, the CIA operative, to go and get rid of their president and put the Shah of Iran in power. We've been screwing with them for decades. And we're screwing with them still. With all the sanctions that we've been placing on Iran, this is how wars get instigated, folks. This is how wars get started. This is how we got the Japanese to attack us with sanctions. What they're doing is with Iran is they're devaluing their economy. They're destroying their economy with these sanctions, and they're only going to put up with it for so long. And we know exactly, by we, I mean the government, the United States government, knows exactly what they're doing. This is how we're instigating the country, we're instigating Iran into war. So get ready for World War III, people, because it's going to happen. And if you haven't got your preps ready, if you haven't got your food storage, well, you better put it in overdrive. You better get a move on real quick, because you're wondering why the price of gas is going up again. This is why. So that's this is your last warning, because things are going to start getting real quick. We're looking at the beginning of the end here, and we're not just looking at the beginning of the end in just on that front alone. There's another story that has been going around, something that I reported on months ago, and I'm not sure if I want to get fully into it right now, because we're going to have to take a break pretty soon. But everything that's going on in the rest of the Middle East, you know, this is some bad mojo, folks. And don't even come to me with this anti-Semite bull. You know, we're not talking about Jews. We're talking about Zionists. And there's a big difference between Zionists and Jews. Most Orthodox Jews are in opposition to what Israel is doing. They're not in favor for it. There are a lot of outspoken Jewish leaders who are anti-Zionist and anti-Israel. And it even goes back to the religious texts, the Torah. The Torah explicitly states that the people, the Israelites, shall have no country or no state of their own, and to force out the Palestinians out of their own country. I mean, hey, that's the American way, isn't it? You know, that's exactly what we did. Our European forefathers came over here, and you know, just basically, but you know, and I understand the mechanics of it all, and the reasons why this all happened, you know, after World War II, and it's the UN, you know, the UN created the state of Israel, and if you know you're fully awake and you're fighting against a new world order, I mean, the UN is at the heart of that. You know, so supporting Israel is akin to supporting the globalists. You're supporting the United Nations, because the United Nations ostensibly created the state of Israel. And, you know, well, I'm not going to go any further than that. But, you know, before I get any angry emails from any pro-Israel folks out there, I think all I'm saying is you ought to take a second look at what you're supporting. You cannot look at them as victims. You can't even look at it as a Jewish issue or a Semitic issue. It's not. It's a Zionist issue, and it's ugly, and it's the globalist agenda. It's ugly. It's evil, and they're going to manufacture a war with Iran. And don't let your kids die in it. If you're thinking about joining the military, some of my younger listeners who are listening right now, you're thinking about joining the military, and you think about serving your country. It is very noble to serve your country, but I would implore anybody right now who's thinking of joining the military to just forget about it, because you're not serving your country. You are not serving your country in the military. You are serving the globalist owners. You're serving the global agenda, the New World Order. You're serving the corporations. Those are the only entities that benefit from these wars that we're involved in. You're not fighting for America. You're fighting for Halliburton. You're fighting for Exxon. You're fighting for British Petroleum. You're not fighting for your country. Do not make the mistake of thinking that our soldiers who make the supreme sacrifice in war, that one single drop of blood has been shed to preserve our freedom. They are being used. Our military, you are being used. I respect you. You're my brothers. I love you. But you're not fighting for America. You're fighting for the corporations. You're fighting for the oligarchy. You're fighting for blood and money and oil and dominance, world domination. None of this is making us freer. Because look what's happening here in America. We are under siege from within. Our enemies are no longer external. Our enemies are domestic. Our enemies are in Washington. Our government is corrupt. Our president is a fraud. He's a villain. And that's going to be my next topic. But we're going to take a quick break right now. So just stick around, and we'll be right back.
American gardeners and fellow patriots, make the right choice with your money, time, and your family food supply. Choose 100% pure heirloom seeds in the Survival Seed Vault from MyPatriotSupply.com. Why spend more? The Survival Seed Vault from MyPatriotSupply.com is only $37.95 and includes 20 varieties of pure, hardy, easy-to-grow heirloom seeds. Yes, only $37.95. That's 70% less than our competitors. You could buy three Survival Seed Vaults for less than one of theirs. The Survival Seed Vault from MyPatriotSupply.com includes detailed planting and seed saving instructions and ships same day. Plus, all orders over $49 ship free. MyPatriotSupply.com is American owned by patriots like you, passionate about freedom and preparedness. Call now, 866-229-0927. That's 866-229-0927. Or discover more emergency preparedness items when you order at MyPatriotSupply.com. Choose the original. Choose the Survival Seed Vault at MyPatriotSupply.com.
Silver has been in use as an effective antimicrobial for thousands of years, and this old technology is still in use today. In 2001, a patent was approved for a new medical silver application, nanocatalytic silver hydrosols. Unlike conventional colloidal silver products, some of the advantages of nanosilver include up to 300% greater bioavailability, proven non-toxicity in over 25 university and FDA-approved laboratory studies, and extreme stability with a shelf life of over 10 years, guarantee. With just one product, you can replace all the antibiotics, wound and burn dressings, and water purification products in your medical bug-out bag. These products have been patented for use against some of the deadliest pathogens known, many that are resistant to traditional antibiotics, yet are safe and gentle enough for treating a baby's diaper rash. To learn more about this medical silver breakthrough and see the published scientific studies, visit www.lifesilver.com. All orders ship within 24 hours with deep discounts and free shipping for case orders. That's www.lifesilver.com.
Survival is not about the end of the world. It's not about a hypothetical plane crash or the latest violent storm. Survival is about the satisfaction of knowing you can take care of yourself and your family in any situation, anytime, anywhere. CampingSurvival.com was started in 1956. No, not the .com part. The survival part. CampingSurvival.com has over 17,000 urban, wilderness, and preparedness items. Supreme customer service, very low shipping, and no games. We look around to make sure we have the lowest prices. And CampingSurvival.com is 100% USMC veteran-owned. Don't base your survival on the latest spring up on the internet company. Do business with an authority on survival. CampingSurvival.com. Confidence born on preparation.
Okay, and we're back. And the folks at Camping Survival wanted me to remind you guys that you can get 5% off all of your purchases at CampingSurvival.com. All you have to do is enter the coupon code, the special coupon code for Survival and Beyond listeners only. And that coupon code is SB Radio. That's S as in survival, B as in beyond, and radio. Enter that all one word and get 5% off all of your purchases at CampingSurvival.com. Now that we have that out of the way, that brings us to our next issue of concern here, and that is our dictator-in-chief, Barack Hussein Obama, the man who rules by executive order. And I reported on this show about NDAA. That's one of my major concerns, one of the biggest threats to our liberty and to our freedom. And it proves that basically that the Constitution is no longer in effect in America. And I wish that more people would wake up to this. I wish that people would realize that this is not about keeping us safe. This is not about fighting the phony terrorist threat, okay? This is about the taking over of America and the destruction of our Constitution. Now, NDAA has an article in it that allows for the detention, the indefinite detention of American citizens. This is a point that was removed from the document before it was signed under the dark of night by Barry on New Year's Eve while everybody else was celebrating the New Year. Like a thief in the night, he signed this executive order, and the language that specifies the detention of American citizens is very vague to begin with, and until the end of hostilities, that's the term, that's the term of time that the government is allowed to detain Americans for any kind of transgression whatsoever. It states supporting Al-Qaeda or our enemies, the enemies of the United States, whatever. But it could be interpreted to mean anything. It could mean dissent. It could mean what I'm talking about right now. It could be expressing your opinion. It could be expressing your dissatisfaction. It could be anything. It's a total affront to our First Amendment and Fifth Amendment rights and to our Constitution as a whole. Now, before this document was signed behind our backs, the language that allowed for the detention of American citizens was removed. Barry insisted that it be put back in. And yet he turns around and he makes a statement like this, and I quote, "The fact that I support this bill as a whole does not mean I agree with everything in it. And in particular, I have signed this bill despite having serious reservations with certain provisions that regulate the detention, interrogation, and prosecution of suspected terrorists." Now, if he doesn't support that, then why did he insist that it be placed in there? And moreover, although I have granted these, I've granted myself these powers, and I'm paraphrasing right now. I don't have the quote right in front of me, but he says, "Although this provides me with these powers, I will never use them. Trust me." Trust you. Trust you. You can't believe a word the guy says. Nobody knows who he is. He has not proven his legitimacy or his eligibility to hold the rank of president. His Social Security number has been proven to be a fake. His Selective Service registration has been determined to be a fake. He has yet to provide a birth certificate that is not a constructed document, slapped together in Photoshop or whatever, right? But I'm not going to get into the whole birther issue or anything like that. But how the hell can we trust him about anything, But anyway, moreover, as I was starting to say, if he is so damn set against this provision in NDAA, then why is he fighting this in court? I reported on survivalandbeyond.net about Judge Catherine Forrest, a few months ago, I reported on her temporary injunction against the article that provides for the detention of American citizens. And then also she issued a permanent injunction, which, I was jazzed about that, man. I'll tell you what, it's like it's a good day when you have something positive to report about the fight against tyranny and the fight against the fight for our freedom. And immediately the Obama administration filed for an appeal. And they got a stay on the order. They got a temporary stay on the order. So, in other words, that article of the NDAA is still in effect until the end of this month, until September 28th, and during which time he has full reign to detain American citizens. He already has exercised his executive power to assassinate, to murder American citizens abroad. He's already done that with drone strikes. He's got a kill list, and believe me, you don't have to believe me. This is a matter of fact. There are American citizens on Barry's drone kill list. He does not even attend meetings with his security advisors. And he's operating. He's a rogue element. He doesn't listen to his advisors. He and he alone determines who the targets are of these drone strikes. As I mentioned earlier, these drone strikes that kill that 90% of the victims are innocent civilians and children. And he functions with impunity. So to anybody, I don't feel any shame at all whatsoever or any trepidation about calling him a freaking dictator. That is what he is. And if Congress doesn't agree with him, then all he does is he signs an executive order. He's already signed 900 executive orders in his first term as president so far. Now let's connect the dots a little bit. Let's see what these 900 are. Let's see what some of these more virulent executive orders allow him to do, and let's see if we see a pattern developing. Let's take a look. This is another executive order that's gotten a lot of buzz in the social media, and this is an executive order that I also reported on months ago on Survival and Beyond on this very show. That's the executive order 13603 that enables or grants Obama emergency powers and the ability to declare martial law. I mean, that's what most of his executive orders are. And this is the National Defense Resources Preparedness Act. Among other things, Obama claims that it allows us to be prepared in the event of a potential threat to the security of the United States to take actions necessary to ensure the availability of adequate resources and production capability, including services, critical technology for national defense requirements. Among the things that that he is allowed to do under this executive order is he is allowed, this gives him the authority to nationalize. Now, notice they say nationalize, which basically means to seize, to take over private assets in order to protect national interests. And furthermore, to identify requirements for emergencies, assess the capability of the country's industrial and technological base, be prepared to ensure the availability of critical resources in a time of national threat, improve the efficiency of the industrial base to support national defense, and foster cooperation between commercial and defense sectors. Now, basically what this means is the federal government can come and commandeer anything they want. They can take your car. They can take your house. They can take your business. If you have any skills that they require, then they can conscript you into service without pay, which is specified, which, by the way, I think that qualifies as slavery. And we did away with that with the 13th Amendment, if I'm not mistaken. And it allows him to declare martial law. Now, there are a number of other executive orders that this one is particularly concerning, and people are finally waking up to this. There's buzz on YouTube about this in the last couple of days, and Facebook, and all the all the patriots and the libertarian folks are getting informed about this, which is great. But the thing is that, you know, this happened a few months ago, and this should have been a big issue back then, back in March when it was originally signed. But March 22nd, but it's getting around now, so that's the important thing. But this is just one of many executive orders. This is 13603 executive order 13617, blocking property of the government of the Russian Federation relating to the disposition of highly enriched uranium extracted from nuclear weapons. Obama says that the risk of nuclear proliferation created by the accumulation of a large volume of weapons-usable fissile material in the territory of the Russian Federation continues to constitute an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security and foreign policy of the United States, and hereby declare a national emergency to deal with the threat. So, you know, Russia is not allowed to have uranium, apparently. We're supposed to be blocking them. They've had nuclear weapons for forever, for, you know, nearly as long as we've had them. But this actually declares it, the signing of this particular executive order declares a national emergency. Now, all that he needs to put any of these executive orders into action is for there to be a national emergency present. And it doesn't have to be a disaster. It doesn't have to be. Already, they're laying the groundwork. Now, there's another executive order which allows Obama to commandeer all of our communication systems in the event of an emergency. He's actually said that he plans to use it on a regular basis just to keep the American people apprised of what's going on. You know, really, you know, the last thing that the government wants to do is for the American people to be apprised of what's really going on. What this really means is that he wants to distribute propaganda and keep people brainwashed and ignorant and misinformed. But this executive order, 13618, entitled The Assignment of National Security and Emergency Preparedness Communications Functions, Obama states that the federal government must have the ability to communicate at all times and under all circumstances to carry out its most critical and time-sensitive missions. Such communications must be possible under all circumstances to ensure national security, effectively manage emergencies, and improve national resilience. And this is already in place. They've already got the hardware in place. Obama, right now, at the push of a button, he can take over every TV station, every TV network, every radio station in the country, and that's it, folks. That's all you're going to get. Once he decides like that he's going to take it over, that's all the news is only going to come from the government. It's only going to come from the White House. It's only going to come from Obama. He cites national security in this executive order once again, and this is the common language of all of these executive orders. So it's giving him any excuse at all to declare a national security emergency, this is all about image. This is all about perception. So it's not perceived as him taking over all of our communications assets by force, you know. And then let's take a look briefly at some of these other executive orders. Executive Order 10990 allows the government to take over all modes of transportation and control all highways and seaports. Executive Order 10997 allows the government to take over all electrical power, gas, petroleum, fuels, minerals. 11000 allows the government to mobilize civilians into work brigades under government supervision. Some of us already knew about that. 11002 designates the Postmaster General to operate a national registration of all persons. National ID, show us your papers, keep tabs on everybody so they know where everybody is, where to find them, how to round them up. Executive Order 11003 allows the government to take over all airports, aircraft, including commercial aircraft. 11004 allows the Housing and Finance Authority to relocate and establish new locations for populations. And this ties in with the Agenda 21 plan, where they want to round people up and get them out of rural areas, take away their assets, and deprive the American citizens of tapping or utilizing our natural resources. They already have these habitation zones planned. I've talked about this on the show before. You can see it. The UN has maps already drawn out with all these areas in urban locations and cities where I've been calling them human habitation zones. I don't think that's exactly what the UN's calling them, but they are habitation zones, and that's what they want to do. They want to take everybody's cars away, and this goes along with all – this is in harmony with their so-called sustainable development, this phony green agenda, which is actually a globalist agenda. It's a globalist agenda of control. Get them out of the rural areas. Pack them into these concrete high-rises near public transportation, which they will control, and nobody's going to be allowed to drive cars, and they're going to keep people concentrated. It's going to be like ghettos. It's going to be like the Nazi ghettos. Cram everybody into the cities and control them that way. Let's see, what else? Executive Order 11004, I already mentioned that. That's the Housing and Finance. Executive Order 11005 allows the government to take over railroads, inland waterways, and public storage facilities. So what do all these executive orders have in common? This is all about federal government commandeering of everything. And if this doesn't smell like martial law to you, then maybe you need to wake up, because that's exactly what it's looking like. I don't see any other way of saying this. All of these executive orders are meant for one thing and one thing only: to control the American populace. And nobody reports on these things. You never hear about it in the media. Most of the time, these executive orders are quietly signed with little press coverage or media attention whatsoever, because, as we all know, the media is completely controlled by our owners, by the powers that be, by the globalists, the New World Order, whatever you want to call it, whatever flavor or, you know, whatever your particular theory is, you know, it's getting pretty clear that this is not a theory anymore. This is not a conspiracy theory. Do you get this? Do those of you who still think that this is some kind of crackpot, crazy conspiracy, nut job idea? This is real, folks. This is real. It's right here in black and white. You can look it up for yourself, these executive orders. There is definitely a pattern here, and it's definitely showing that there's going to be a takeover. And this is what we're looking at, and it's not too far away. Oh yeah, and by the way, that other provision in the NDAA also allows for the president to cancel the elections. Yep, which is what I've been talking about, and I've merely been speculating on it. But the way it's worded vaguely enough that it could be interpreted that way, that the elections could be just called off because of a national security threat, a state of emergency, which has already been established with with 13603. 13617, the executive order blocking property of the government of the Russian Federation. So here is where we are, people. We are in a state of national emergency, and the president has declared himself with all the dictatorial powers that he needs to basically take us over. That's it. That's the end of America. Now, this is a time where we all have to ask ourselves, are we going to continue to keep taking this and keep knuckling under, keep allowing our liberties and freedoms to be taken away from us little by little, or are we going to stand up and say, no more, this is the line, no further? The way I see it, there's only two things that can happen. One, there's a second American Revolution. Don't want to see it happen, but if it comes down to it, that's probably what's going to happen. Or two, there aren't going to be enough people with backbone, enough people who remember what America is all about, or whoever learned what America is all about with our federally funded school system, our indoctrination system, our conditioning system. There's not going to be enough people with backbone that will stand up for this, that will draw that line in the sand and say, this far, no further. Well, it's up to us. And are we going to take this? Are we going to have our rights and liberties taken away from us? Are we going to have our firearms taken away from us? Are we going to have our land, our property, our life, our pursuit of happiness taken away from us? That's what this entire web, this entire structure is spelling out. And if it's not, you know, spelling it out to you, I highly encourage you to go and check it out for yourself. Do not take my word for anything. I implore people. I tell people all the time, don't take my word for it. Go out and see for yourself, because I'm passionate. And sometimes in my passion, you know, I just want to get the information out there. And this is it. This is your starting point. If you know, if you say this isn't enough to convince you, it shouldn't be. You know, I'll tell you right now, this should not be enough to convince you, but this should be enough to get you concerned. This should be enough so that you can go online and you can look up these things for yourself, and you don't have to go into some dark, arcane conspiracy sites or whatever to find this out. You can go right on the government websites and look this up. It's a matter of public record. Don't even need to file a Freedom of Information Act report to find out about these executive orders. And it's frightening. It's frightening what's happening. And this is not something coming down the road anymore. You know, this is my call to action. You know what? I used to give calls to action on my show whenever there was an affront to our freedom and to our liberty, and when bills were being passed, and I would say, you know, call your congressman, or I would encourage people to sign petitions, right? Forget about it. Forget about that, because it's pointless. It's useless. I don't even think voting matters anymore at this point. What Americans need to do right now is you need to stop the right-left Democrat-Republican paradigm. Forget about being a Republican. Forget about being a Democrat. Start thinking about being an American. Okay? Stop participating in the game. Stop allowing yourselves to be manipulated. Do not be a voluntary participant in your own enslavement. Okay? That is the only way that we can win this without, hopefully without violence, without, I'm a wholehearted proponent of nonviolent solutions, about passive civil disobedience, and that's basically it. It's civil disobedience. Stop participating when you're confronted by a police officer who wants to infringe and step on your rights because he doesn't think that you're aware of them. And maybe, you know what, a lot of them aren't even aware of them themselves. You know, the power of impunity, the impunity of having a badge. Stand up for your rights. Do not be afraid anymore. Do not knuckle under because you're afraid to take a stand. Do not allow your rights to be violated. Demand to see a warrant before your car or your home is searched. Know your rights. Get down to it. You can download the Constitution on survivalandbeyond.net. And there's lots of places where you can find this information. Just stop being a sheep. Stop being a slave. We are not slaves. We are sovereign human beings. And we have rights, and we cannot allow them to be violated anymore. So just don't play the game. You owe it to your children. You owe it to our future.
Do you know someone who can benefit from this radio program? You can find the complete archives of this show and hundreds of others at naturalnewsradio.com. Just send your friend that link, naturalnewsradio.com, where they will find truly amazing interviews and information that simply isn't published anywhere else. In the Natural News Radio archives, you'll find interviews with Dr. Andrew Wakefield, Senator Rand Paul, Governor Jesse Ventura, Suzanne Summers, alternative cancer doctors, nutrition experts, preparedness experts, and a wealth of others. And it's all free. Listen in real time at naturalnewsradio.com or download the MP3 archive files anytime you want to listen on your phone, mobile devices, or personal computer. When you want articles on these topics, check out naturalnews.com with over 35,000 article pages on nutrition, natural cures, health freedom, and much more. It's all part of the Natural News Network. Thanks for listening.
Have you ever wanted to learn where you can get free food and medicine from the plants growing around your neighborhood? Or how to turn your own backyard into a food production center? Or even how to reverse cancers using the latest groundbreaking research in alternative cancer therapies? You can learn all this and more from webseed.com. It's sort of like Netflix, but it's for documentaries and how-to courses on natural health, food production, self-reliance, and other life-saving topics. I'm Mike Adams, the Health Ranger, and I created WebSeed so that listeners like you could get instant streaming access to truly groundbreaking instructional courses. Our new program called Vaccines Armed and Dangerous exposes the total fraud of modern vaccine quackery, and our Survival course teaches emergency preparedness, including skills like how to build your own emergency water filter. Explore over 100 valuable courses and documentaries right now at WEBSEED.com.
Heart-related health problems affect millions of people each year. Maybe you're one of the many who suffer from issues related to angina pain, high blood pressure, congestive heart failure, unbalanced cholesterol, irregular heartbeat, or clogged arteries. There is a solution that doesn't involve expensive prescription drugs that only mask the problem and leave you with horrible side effects. If you are ready to live your life free of sickness, pain, and fear, live your life with increased vitality, energy, and youthfulness, and experience experience your body healing itself, then you're ready for Heart and Body Extract from Healthy Hearts Club. Heart and Body Extract has a 23-year proven track record of using certified organic herbs that make up an excellent formula to balance and support the heart and circulatory system. In as little as 2 weeks, you can feel amazing results when your 2-month supply of Heart and Body Extract today. Call 1-866-295-5305 or go to hbextract.com.
Okay, and we're back, and our guest today is Christopher Nierjesh, and Christopher has literally taught thousands of people survival and self-reliance skills going back decades, back to the early 70s, and he's one of those guys who, he walks the talk, man. He's been there and back, and he's a real deal, and he's written a number of books on survival and self-reliance, including How to Survive Anywhere, The Self-Reliant Home, Extreme Simplicity. And he's really about self-reliance, and you can see he's had numerous television appearances as well as on YouTube. And without any further delay, it's my honor to welcome him to the show. So welcome to the show, Chris.
Glad, it's good to be with you tonight.
Yeah, same here. I'm glad I've been meaning to call you and have you on the show for a long time, and glad that we're finally doing it.
It was nice to meet you when we finally met in Salt Lake City, I believe it was, at the Survival Show.
Mm-hmm. It was cool. I wish I could have had more time. I was kind of being dragged around to...
Yeah, it was a very educational show, and I didn't have enough time either. You know, there's so many people that you want to meet and talk to at an environment like that. It's very enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like I was preaching to the choir in Salt Lake City. You know, I mean, mostly Mormon people, they are so involved in a lot of the survival and preparedness.
I know. Are you going to tell them, like, you got to start storing food, and you got to start, they already know that stuff.
Right. But when I was there, see, I'm from Southern California, but when I was there, in the morning we drove around along the freeways and wet areas, and I filled my booth with plants that were found from the countryside and the roadside of Utah there. And that was rather educational. If you remember, there was snow on the ground that weekend in October.
Yeah.
And most of the booths were selling kits and things in buckets and stoves and dried food and sprouts and a lot of books. And you had your magazine. And there were a few things you could actually do. In my booth, we had loads of plants, and I was demonstrating how to make fire with a bow and drill all day long. And I brought yucca from California, and I was showing how to make twine and rope. And some of the organizers saw that we were making fire there, and they weren't too happy, but they brought us a fire extinguisher. I mean, it was a cement floor. We're not going to cause a fire in the convention hall, but people enjoyed it. We had a crowd all day learning how to make fire with the bow and drill, with the hand drill, and learning how to make a Paiute a Mojave quail trap with twigs. And these are the things that I do in my classes regularly. It was a little bit challenging to do it on a cement floor in a convention center.
Yeah.
But people seemed to like it. And I had a really good time.
Yeah. It's a challenge starting a fire with a bow and drill anywhere.
Well, tell me about it. I mean, I don't know if you're aware, but I've been involved and interested in these primitive and survival and outdoor and self-reliant skills since I was a boy. My mother grew up on a farm, and she used to always tell us about what things were like in the 30s and, you know, during the Depression and the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't have electricity. They had an outhouse. And I really longed to learn a lot of the skills. It wasn't that I wanted to live on a farm, but I was acutely aware, living in the city, how reliant everybody is on someone else. And
mm-hmm.
So in my early teens, I became aware of Native Americans not as things in museums, but as real living people, because they were among, they did, they're still around everywhere in Southern California. And a lot of my friends I got to know were Native Americans. And a lot of the crafts and skills, of course, are lost arts too. But the hand drill, probably more than the bow and drill, was what was used universally throughout the Americas. But I remember reading in Larry Dean Olson's Outdoor Survival Skills book. Do you know Larry Dean? He went to Brigham Young. He taught at Brigham Young. I think he lives in Idaho now. But that was the Bible for me, Outdoor Survival Skills by Larry Dean Olson. and I learned how to do a fire with a bow and drill. But I'd have to say that he covers a lot of material, and there are little details that you need to learn with a teacher face-to-face. But I was persistent, and I must have practiced trying to make a fire with a bow and drill 100 times. I could always get smoke, but I didn't know where I was going with it, and I always used inappropriate wood. And one day, just by sheer willpower, I refused to stop until I succeeded, and it took me 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
3 hours, and my hands were blistered, and
blistered.
I was sweat. And I couldn't believe that I suddenly got a coal. And for those of you who know what I'm talking about, you need to have a little notch on the side of your board. I didn't even have a notch. That's how ignorant I was. I got the coal. I went back. You know, it had sort of popped out. So
yeah.
I went back to Larry Dean's book, and I said, oh. And I made the little notch, and in 15 minutes this time I had my coal. And I went through the learning process myself, and I think this is why some of my students, you know, they have the benefit of all of my mistakes. They come to my classes, and there's guys that are really quick, and they get it right away. But when you're drilling, you drill through the hearth or the flat piece of wood. You create, you're drilling through it eventually. You get so many coals. But because I wasn't doing it right, I would drill through, and I thought, well, I'll use a harder wood for the hearth so I don't drill all the way through and have to start a new hole. So I was using African mineral wood, which is a big mistake. And then my drill would get smaller too, so I used this long broom handle, if you can believe that. So it was pine wood, which is not a great choice. And so, you know, I did it in spite of my extreme ignorance. And then eventually I learned about willow and cottonwood and ash and all the appropriate woods. And it really is was an art. The knowledge of the woods is important. The whole way in which people would have learned these things in the past would have been a very organic method in the family and passed from father to son and, you know, from through the generations. And so that's kind of what I try to do. I get people, you know, who say, I've tried this, I couldn't do it. So when you're actually standing with somebody and listening to them, and I have assistants that help me too, I can hear, well, they're pressing too hard, or their rope is slipping, you know, and they say, oh, okay, and I'll let them adjust it. I used to hate it when I had teachers, and it doesn't matter what the subject is, but where there's a hands-on thing, like learning something on a computer and the person insists on being at the keyboard and doing it themselves, you don't learn that way. So
no.
You have to let people make their mistakes and learn by doing. And it's amazing. To this day, I get people who get fire for the first time by their own power with just wood and friction, and they're so overjoyed. I mean, have you done it, for example? Just curious. Not trying to put you on the spot, Ed, but have you done it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I've done it, and I hope I never have to do it again, but at least I know how to do it if I do have to do it again.
Well, this is why I always carry magnesium fire starters and all kinds of things with me, because once you do it, you can always reproduce that effort and get the coal. But it is work, and I remember one of my classes. This was I teach a class at Pasadena City College on survival skills. It runs a couple of evenings, and one of the nights we focused on fire and one on water and a variety of things. But one of our last classes, this lady insisted on knowing, what do I put in my survival kit if I had to evacuate?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and actually I wouldn't answer the question right away. And, because I was asking her, well, where are you going? Okay, you have to evacuate. Where are you going? Hey, do you know what your neighborhood looks like? Do you have a place to go to? Well, no, but I have to evacuate. Okay, are you by yourself or are you with friends? No, I tried to go through all of the thinking that if you're seriously interested in evacuating somewhere safely because of an emergency, you really want to think through first, right? Before there's an emergency. So, in this lady's case, she didn't know the neighborhood, big mistake. She didn't really have any friends. So I told her, that's the worst possible thing. Think about that. You're a woman by yourself. You're not going to have a firearm, and you don't know where you're going. So really, evacuation is only something you do if you absolutely have no other choice. You know, you prepare your home and you have things stored there, and people should get to know their neighbors, and you should have defense systems. And the defense system isn't just a firearm. Defense system is a strategy. It's people you work together. It's you know, avoiding trouble in the first place. But my point in this story is that eventually we did list, because everybody always wants to know what's in your kit, you know. And so my style of teaching is I don't usually just answer the questions, because I find that when I was taught that way and the teacher spouts off all of their intelligence, I don't remember it because they're just feeding it to me on a silver platter, right?
Right.
I don't remember it. But I've had a few good teachers over the years who insisted that I answer, do the thinking, think it through. You tell me. So I do that all the time. And so I wrote on the board pack contents. So I had the students, okay, what would we carry in this hypothetical pack now? So everybody said, of course, a knife or a cutting tool of some sort. You know, I let them decide what kind of a knife. I mean, there's a couple of things that I consider indispensable. And then a fire starter. By the time they took my class, they knew that I'm big on you have to have some fire starter. I mean,
mm-hmm.
And then, but then I said, okay, so, but what would you carry specifically in the case? And several of them said bow and drill for an evacuation pack. And I said, what on earth would you carry that for? That's big and that's bulky and that takes time.
Right.
Think about it. You're learning how to do that so you could go somewhere with absolutely nothing. You know, you walk into the woods, you walk into a vacant lot, and you could find you don't have anything. You didn't prepare. That's why you go do that. Why would you carry that with you? And you know, I mean, mm-hmm. unless it's an educational experience.
Yep.
In a survival kit, you want a big lighter. You want a lighter. You want a light immediately. You want a magnesium fire starter, which will give you thousands of lights. You want a tool of that sort, flint and steel.
I'm glad you said that, because there's a prevalent mindset to people, novices to survival and self-reliance, who believe that everything has to be done the hard way. You have to do everything the most inconvenient. And when I tell people, you know, have like three or four Bic lighters, have a magnesium rod, have, you know, some flint and steel or something like that, and people are like, well, isn't that cheating? It's like, this is
cheating
survival. This
yeah,
is
cheating who?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're just...
No, I hear that too, because sometimes on my... One of the classes that I've done, you know, I've been teaching classes since 1974, and for years all I did was wild food walks and, you know, wild plant walks, and I've expanded into just about everything. But I would bring a bowl, and I'd bring salad dressing, and maybe a tomato and an avocado.
Mm-hmm.
And people would say, oh, my God, is that cheating? I said, what do you mean? They said, well, you got that from the store. And I said, so? You know, in other words, I'm not necessarily teaching outright survival, although I am. It's good to know those skills. I'm teaching people how to use nature to supplement what they have, maybe in a situation of limited supply, where you can't go to the stores. You want to be able to take what you have and expand it. So if you have a dressing or you have a few condiments, you can take the greens and the things from the store, and instead of feeding one person, you could feed 10. If you're into MREs, you can add some wild greens like lamb's quarter and make it into a broth and serve 20 rather than 2, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So cheating is all of a relative, it's a relative term. I do think that if you are trying to learn these things, you know, and it's a situation of your choosing under your timetable, yes, leave the matches and fire starter at home and go into the woods and figure it out. You know, or maybe you could hide one in your pack if you're worried about actually being mm-hmm. in a bad situation.
Yeah,
but that is one of the ways that you learn it. You just do without fire, or you do without a knife, or you do without a sleeping bag. Just take one thing away. Do without food. You know, I've gone without food so many times. That's easy, well, relatively easy. It depends on the place and the timing. But then it forces you to think in just that one area until it's comfortable for you. See, this the people who are trying to learn this, they don't have to think in terms of the end of the world or comet hits the earth. You can actually think about it as a life-enhancing skill like you would any other skill and just expand from what you already know, or just to expand your threshold of abilities from, let's say you lose your knife, then what do? You know, suddenly you don't have it. You know, you can sharpen wood, you can sharpen a bone, you can sharpen a rock, you can find scrap metal, you can find glass, and learn how to use it safely. So, you know, I mean, one by one, but specifically for thinking about a bug-out bag, an emergency pack where you have to run, that's a whole different thing. The guys that say you're cheating by carrying a Bic are guys who have never actually done it.
Exactly.
I mean, if they think you need to care and do everything yourself, what on earth are they talking about? That, it's good to know how to do those things. Don't get me wrong. You know, it's good to know how to do those things, and I encourage people to know that. And it's like a lifestyle skill to be able to do these things, to live better with less. I mean, that's I think that's the whole self-reliance thing. Live better with less. Learn how to make things. Learn how to do without, because there's so many things that we think we must have that are indispensable that we don't need at all. But certainly, if you're thinking that you might have to evacuate, you want everything to be easy. You want some quick food. You want fire. Maybe a water container. You know, you can't carry all the water that you need, but a water container. I'm big on cordage. By the way, do you ever look at our Dirt Time forum, dirttime.com?
I have, and I've seen actually I've seen the videos as well, and I wanted to mention that to our listeners. And while we're at it, I just want to let everybody know that your school is called the School of Self-Reliance, and why don't you tell our listeners where they can find your website?
Well, they can. I have a dormant site that goes to the active site, but if they go to self-reliance.net, they'll find me. If they know how to spell my name, ChristopherNYERGES.com, they'll find me also. That's my active site where I have my store. I have a blog there where I talk about all kinds of things and a schedule, of course, of all the classes if you live in Southern California. But I get people coming from, you know, San Diego to San Francisco, although mostly from, you know, within 50 miles or so. They come and take my weekend classes.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of interesting things on the blog, and I have links to people that I like, and that I work with, and that who are friends of mine who do similar classes. Unfortunately, there really aren't that many. And I'm, you know, it's somewhat of a business, but I really do think of it as something that I've always done because I like doing it, and I believe that it helps to save humanity. You know, my father used to always ask me, "Why don't I get a real job?" If I was a businessman, I'm sure I would have been doing something else long ago, but I do these skills because I love it and I love sharing with people, and it's more or less supported me all these years.
Oh, yeah. None of us are doing this to get rich, I can tell you that.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, it has inherent benefits because, I mean, just by teaching others, I've had to stay a few steps ahead of the students and learn new skills. There's so many things that I don't buy that I know I don't need,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's like I don't have a fear of what if, because I know I've gone without it, you know. I mean, there's nothing like that experience of knowing you can do something or do without because you've actually done it, not because you've seen it on YouTube.
Right.
I can't tell you, and even in the pre-YouTube days, I saw it online or I saw a video about it. Okay, well, that's good. So then when people tell me that, I tell them, okay, you show all of our class now how to do such and such, flint knapping or fire making, whatever it is. Oh, well, I've never actually done it.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, well, but I want you to do it anyway because you just said you know about it. Now, I'm not trying to humiliate people.
No.
Because occasionally somebody having seen something and watched it and studied it really can do it. So, you know, remember the movie The Edge? The Anthony Hopkins character was in a plane wreck. He hadn't really done a lot of the survival stuff, but he had read about it, and he was a bright guy, and he was a quick learner. And he kept himself alive and kept the group largely alive. I mean, you know what movie I'm talking about, Ed?
I haven't seen that movie, no.
Oh, you got to see it. That's a good movie.
I don't even think I've heard of that. I haven't.
The Edge. The Edge is a very good. I always like to recommend books and movies to get specific lessons across that you couldn't really get across intellectually through a classroom talking about topics, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, the movies put it in a real life setting, fictitious generally, but The Edge I think it's supposed to be a Bill Gates kind of a guy, and his wife is having an affair with somebody who's actually on the trip with them. So there's a setting, there's a plot that's developing, but the plane crashes in the remote areas of Alaska. And, you know, they have to get out of there on their own. And it's a very rugged terrain. There's bears. It's cold. They need mm-hmm. fire. It's a fascinating movie. I don't want to give anything away, but Anthony Hopkins totally proves himself to be the real survivor and taking the higher road to the very end, the higher road. And too many survivalists think, you know, if they watch that TV show Survivor, Survival, it's called? Survivor? Survivor, right?
The game show type.
Yeah, the game show. Who wants to be a millionaire in costume?
I've not watched a single episode of that. I'm proud.
You haven't missed much.
I know.
You haven't missed much. I watched the very beginning one, and it had some interesting moments. But it's all about how to get rid of the guys that have skills, so you mm-hmm. can try to win the game. And it's about how to play the game. It's not about how to play the game of life.
Right.
Because in real life, you need to be like Anthony Hopkins. You need to be thinking about the other guy. You need to be thinking about the group. You need to be cooperating. You know, it's a whole different reality than a game show. And but The Edge is really good. I like it, and I highly recommend it. Another one, by the way, since you brought up movies, or was it me that brought up movies?
That was you.
That was me. Okay, another good one is Book of Eli. Have you seen that one?
I haven't gotten around to see that either. I live pretty much out in the middle of nowhere, and I don't get out much to see movies.
That's good. Well, occasionally they let me out of my box, and I go down, either rent a video or go to the theater. I saw The Book of Eli when it came out in a big theater, and I think that's that movie you really should see on the big screen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have friends who are heavily into survival that said the movie was an absolute waste of their time, had no redeeming benefits. I totally disagree. I mean, everybody has their own opinion. The Denzel Washington character was an incredible character. This is like a post-apocalyptic world. It wasn't mm-hmm. like the world we know. There were no cities anymore. Most people were either dead, and most of the landscape looked bare. And his whole thing was he had this Bible, and he was trying to get it to the West Coast, to some community that he heard about. And so it's about his adventures, how you find food, how you find water, what mm-hmm. kind of people there are. Fascinating, fascinating story. And, you know, that will probably never happen, is my guess. But I don't watch them just for entertainment. I watch them, I try to suspend a little bit of belief and ask myself, well, what if this element could happen? That's an interesting point, lack of water, let's say. The reality is not... The reason why we watch the movies, or at least I recommend my students often watch certain movies, it is not because of entertainment. It's because you can pick out certain elements and say, what if that actually happened? What would I do? What are the applications to me? Okay.
Mm.
So that's the reason why I recommend watching them. I mean, if you're fantasizing and you're trying to live in that situation and try to learn something vicariously, and then it's not Boy Scout skills that are going to get you through. It's people skills in almost all cases.
Yeah.
You're always dealing with people. I mean, too many survival books, and I could even be a little bit guilty of this too, but we focus on the things. And so much of it is not about things, but it's about people, the relationships you have, the way you deal with other people, the way you respect or disrespect other people.
Yep.
You know, you mentioned my How to Survive Anywhere book.
Right.
When we started. Now, that's still my most popular book. I'm very happy about that. And I wanted to call it something else, like about universal survival principles, but that's kind of boring. So the publisher's title worked pretty good. But
the publisher's.
Yeah, well, it's their prerogative. When you publish a book, as you might know, you get married to somebody for
right.
a couple of years, and they're you get divorced when the book is out of print, but they're putting the money up front and they're doing things, and so you work together. It's a cooperative venture. But my last chapter on page 250 of how to survive anywhere is called What is Survival? And I don't know how many people read that, because many times the last chapter is not read, but that's the most important part of the book, as far as I'm concerned. I talk about economic survival.
Mm-hmm.
I talk about the choices that we make. The ethical, moral, spiritual, all of our decisions that affect our survival. You know, I don't use the word karma, I don't think, but I believe that we do get what we earn in life.
Right.
You know, and that I'm not just a positive thinker. It's one thing to be a positive thinker, but positive actor, you know, acting positively and understanding how your actions affect other people. You know, like, mm-hmm. And it's not a religious thing either, but I do, what is it called, the golden rule? Do unto others as you'd have them do unto you?
Sure.
Now that may not, you might say that may not always work in a survival situation, but, you know, if you practice it in daily life, you may not be in that kind of a survival situation where you have to make those really harsh choices.
Yeah, exactly. And people are loath to talk about this and about the human aspect. And I'm glad already in the last few minutes, you've hit upon like three or four key elements that I think are very important and I talk about a lot. I mean, the first one being that, you know, when you, a lot of people, they get mired in books and TV shows and Man versus Wild, and they think watching a video is the same as training. And I don't think there's been a single show or a single opportunity where I passed up the opportunity to impress upon people that, you know, reading a book, you know, like my medium is largely in the printed or, you know, in the textual form. And uh-huh. I always tell people, you know, like, yeah, don't just put this on your shelf and think you're going to refer to it when the crap hits the fan. When you need it. And don't watch Man vs. Wild or watch YouTube videos and think that now you know how to do these things. You actually have to go out in your backyard or go out in the forest somewhere or wherever and actually practice these things, because that's you have knowledge, but knowledge and experience are two different things. And that's the difference between wisdom and knowledge is experience.
Exactly.
As a wiser person than myself once said. And that's what you really need. You need the wisdom of that the experience brings you. And
right.
And when it comes to, you know, dealing with other people, there's the other, you know, the prevalent fantasy is the, you know, the lone wolf syndrome. And you were talking about that woman who, you know, had absolutely no bug out plan. She just knew that she was going to bug out. And, you know, you need to have a plan. And also you have to realize that you can't do these things alone. There's mm-hmm. even in our history, back 100, 200, 300 years ago, our hardiest adventurers and trappers and whatnot and everything, they were reliant on each other, and they had right. meetups at several points during the year, or at least once a year. And
right.
you know, none of us, and it sounds cliche, but none of us are an island. You know, community is very important, and when there is a disaster, we all need to rely on each other, and we all need to know how to deal with other people, conflict resolution. And that's something that you very rarely hear about in discussing survival and preparedness topics.
You rarely hear that.
People think they're just going to go out in the woods and live off the land, and I'm just going to go out.
Right.
And the reality is quite different.
Yeah, in an emergency, there'd be a lot of guys contending for limited resources. And even the whole economic thing, that is almost never mentioned in any of the books, or sometimes in the magazines it's mentioned about it in terms of daily life, but it seems like as much as we like to pretend that doesn't affect every aspect of our lives, it does. You know, it's some kind of article of trade. Even the Native Americans, for God's sake, they used to, you know, baskets and fine arrowheads were money.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody knew what it was and what it took to make it, and so you converted your energy and your work and your thinking into this product, which you could then get, you know, other products that you weren't skillful at making. And that's kind of what money is all about. We've kind of gone over the cliff with the whole thinking about money, but, you know, money should serve us, not us serve it. And I want to write a whole book about it someday before it's too late, but that is what I try to address in the back of in the rear chapter of How to Survive Anywhere, and even in my Extreme Simplicity book, which I highly encourage people to read. You can read about it on my website, Extreme Simplicity. It was how my wife and I, we lived in I don't live there anymore. She passed away 3 years ago, and I'm no longer there, but we were there for about 20 years. We grew our own food, had produced some of our electricity. But money, how we made our money and how I continue to make my living is a diverse thing, but it starts from, obviously, there's the need to produce something in the society and pay your bills. But you can do it a number of ways, and it starts by the things that you love and the things that you know, and then you find those opportunities. Of course, it's just like a survival situation. If you wait to the last minute and there's a flood coming towards your house, you just have to run with whatever you can grab to survive. So if you waited to the last minute and you didn't think about economic survival, and then suddenly you just have to get some kind of a job or whatever based on your panic and your fear and your last minute itis, you know, totally understand that. I've been there before, so I understand it fully. So, I mean, it's sometimes you knew I was homeless in the early 80s for about 6 months, and that was quite an experience. If nothing else, it teaches you that you never want to be in that situation again, and you'll do everything possible to ever come close to being in that kind of a situation.
Right.
You know, but I was very resourceful, and interestingly, none of my family members knew that I was under that situation, and I actually had part-time jobs, and I managed to stay clean, and I had a motorcycle at the time. So I wouldn't say I was exactly embarrassed, but I didn't make a big deal about it, and I didn't, you know, I never got any government handouts. I never went to a soup kitchen. I wasn't like that. I wasn't down on Skid Row. I was just basically camping out in different places, and part of the time in a cellar of a guy's place who didn't know I was there. Yeah. It was an interesting experience. I might write about that more in depth sometime. And I think back on it, it was kind of humorous more than anything. But I learned how, you know, I learned to have some appreciation for these guys who are on the street and try to be helpful in a way that I can. But I also learned just, you know, kind of the value of friendship, because it's friends who were able to get me out of that situation. And, you know, I'm very thankful for that. And I try to give a helping hand to people too, not just give them something, but give them a helping hand to help themselves, you know. So all of these things relate to each other. When I was homeless, I had already, you know, had been teaching survival skills for maybe 10 years. And I still was during that summer, during that period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it for me, in many ways, it was a forced camp out and kind of an adventure. And I thought, wow, this is pretty interesting.
Well, I think it's a very it's a very valid facet of survival. It's just another type of survival altogether. You know, I wouldn't hesitate at all. I think it would be a fascinating book if you were thinking about writing it. That's something that I'd enjoy reading. And
well, it's the thing that I'd always want to emphasize is that at least in our society, very few people choose to be homeless. This is not a society that is nomadic,
right?
Where the concept of homelessness would have no meaning, but because we do have a place, generally most people, they get down on their luck, they don't have money, they lose their job or whatever. A lot of them, frankly, are alcoholics or drug users, and they can't maintain, you know, financial income. So there's that element to keep in mind, that it's no great honor, but it shouldn't be an embarrassment either if you learn from it and got out of it.
Right.
And probably a more interesting period of my life was when I was a squatter. This was for a year and a half. I was, you know, went in a house that was in probate, broke in, had the utilities turned on in my name, told the neighbors what I was doing. Nobody seemed to care. I lived there for a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And I did gardening and all sorts of experiments there, and I basically paid nobody. Oh, I paid the utilities.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a lot of my early writing there. I think my urban wilderness book from 1980 or so arose from that period of time.
Yeah, you know, I went through a period back in my more itinerant days, when I was living a more nomadic lifestyle. I went through a period where I was very interested in the concept of squatting, and I read up a bit on it. And I'd like to come back to that, but first we've got to take a break. And when we come back, I want to continue on with that subject. So everybody just hang tight, and we'll be right back.
Preparing yourself for an emergency doesn't have to be all about doom and gloom. Getting all worked up about an impending disaster isn't going to better prepare you. It's just going to stress you out. Here at survival-gear.com, we believe your main goal when putting together a survival kit is to not just have the critical items you need in order to stay alive, but the right supplies in sufficient quantity to shield you from the effects of an extended unfortunate event. I like to say that if you have to use your survival kit, it should seem more like an impromptu camping trip rather than a dire emergency. Likewise, if a hurricane, earthquake, or tornado make your home unusable, you want to be able to set up camp and still be relatively comfortable. Even during a survival scenario, staying warm, dry, hydrated, and fed doesn't have to seem like roughing it. At survival-gear.com, our goal is to better prepare you by providing full-fledged survival kits that you can absolutely count on. Visit survival-gear.com and check out our premium line of survival kits. Silver has been in use as an effective antimicrobial for thousands of years, and this old technology is still in use today. In 2001, a patent was approved for a new medical silver application, nanocatalytic silver hydrosols. Unlike conventional colloidal silver products, some of the advantages of nanosilver include up to 300% greater bioavailability, proven non-toxicity in over 25 university and FDA-approved laboratory studies, and extreme stability with a shelf life of over 10 years, Guaranteed. With just one product, you can replace all the antibiotics, wound and burn dressings, and water purification products in your medical bug-out bag. These products have been patented for use against some of the deadliest pathogens known, many that are resistant to traditional antibiotics, yet are safe and gentle enough for treating a baby's diaper rash. To learn more about this medical silver breakthrough and see the published scientific studies, visit www.lifesilver.com. All orders ship within 24 hours with deep discounts and free shipping for case orders. That's www.lifesilver.com.
Now, I've gone through a period where I was fascinated with the concept of squatting, and I read up on it a bit. And from my understanding, one of the things that I always read was that if the owner's in absentia, or if he's abandoned the property, as long as you pay the property taxes and nobody objects to you being there, and you obviously contribute to the property by, I mean, obviously you must have had to do some upkeep and some renovations.
I did a lot
to
of
make
upkeep,
it,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, you mentioned squatting to some people and they have a knee-jerk reaction, and it's like, oh, you're just, you know, like it's akin to stealing or something like that. But if it, you know, if everybody's in agreement, and a lot of times people do pay the property taxes on that, and that's all the powers that be care about. As long as they're getting their money, they're not going to bother you. And as long as the owner is, I mean, if they've abandoned it, or in some cases, if you can work out agreements with them and say, hey, look, I'll fix the place up if you let me live here, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's not something I recommend. It's something I kind of fell into and I did it.
Yeah,
it's not something I recommend because it is on the edge of the law, and because you are always at the brink of just having to quickly get out of mm-hmm. there. And if that you don't mind that, that's okay. That's not really my
yeah.
style, but it is what I did. And about 9 months of being there, different people started showing up, and there were two people who claimed to be the heirs of the lady who had died, who had lived there. And then there were two sets of lawyers, and then I sort of unraveled what was happening, and I told them, well, when it's all settled, I'll move, you know. And I was there for another year after that, practically. And they were happy to have me there because I kept the anybody from damage, you know, people might cause, you know, break windows or whatever, and I kept the place looking neat, so there was no criminal activity. So it was actually a positive for everybody.
Right.
So, but during that time, it actually allowed me to practice and put into practice a lot of the things that I now teach, because I had the luxury of not worrying about rents were very different and mortgages were very different back then, but I still had the luxury of not worrying about it. I just, you know, I did have some part-time work, and I did a lot of gardening, and I used alternative toilets just to experiment, and a lot of things along those lines I did. I cooked on a wood stove, not that I had to, but I did a number of experiments in animal raising and so forth, and it was rather eye-opening, and I learned a lot during that period.
Right.
So, you know, people have to find their own way. Everybody always asks me, how do you learn all these? How'd you learn all this? Because they, you know, after a while we're talking and I'm commenting on so many things, but I say, well, you know, I learned it one by one. That's how you learn anything. You want to be an auto mechanic, you learn about what is a spark plug and how it works and how you fix it and what's the distributor, and you just go through the car, go through the electrical system, you go through it one by one.
Mm-hmm.
Same with these skills. You learn what interests you, and then go to the next thing. You know, I mean, I started being a botany student back in high school. I was active in the LA, Los Angeles Mycological Society very active for about 3 years, and learned quite a bit about plants and mushrooms. And that was my first love. So I was a botanist, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you're studying botany, you're learning that Native Americans used the plants, and they used them for other things. Oh, they used them for medicine. So I started studying that. Oh, and they use this for making arrows and this for making fire. So botany was the mother science for me that led in every other direction. So eventually the skill of living off the land, the skill of doing what people did in the past strictly with what nature provided, that, you know, it almost came very naturally. And plus, I teach. So I'm constantly trying to learn something new because I want to learn it, but having something different to provide to the students. And it's amazing the people that have come along over the years that I just kept my ears open. You know, be humble, listen to what new thing you're going to learn this day. And it's amazing how many bits and pieces, because I was out there teaching, how many bits and pieces of things and how-tos came to me. I mean,
right.
it really has been quite an adventure. I mean, I, I love it when I learn something new. I remember thinking I knew it all. You know, I think that's about age 17 or 18, right?
That,
I can't
that's
possibly
about,
learn anymore. I know it all.
That's about the age that you, yeah, and then you gradually start to forget all of the stuff.
Right. You know you're immortal and you know it all, and then after a few years go by, you realize, hey, you know, my dad wasn't as much of an idiot as I thought he was, and
right.
There's more to this than what I already know. No, actually, it's at our annual Dirt Time event, we get some of the masters from around the United States to come, and there's this these two guys from Arizona, Al Cornell and Mike Campbell, and they both have a military background, I believe, and Al Cornell has learned fire starting methods from all around the world. I learned how to make fire with a bit in my mouth and turning a little drill with a string. I don't like that method because there's a little block in my mouth while I'm doing it, and we made fire with bamboo. You know, a lot of exotic methods that I wouldn't normally do,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, you think you know it all, or you know most of it, and then suddenly there's like a whole new world out there.
Yeah, you reminded me of that a quote by Samuel Clemens. He said, when I was 14 years old, my father was so ignorant, I was embarrassed to be in the same room with him. When I was 21, I was amazed at how much he had learned in 7 years.
Yeah, yeah. So that's life, isn't it? You grow
yeah.
up, you realize that there's always something more to learn. There's always another nuance.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I'm concerned, that's kind of what life is all about. You know, you want to humble yourself to be able to accept it. I always let students talk, you know, I mean, within reason, of course, and sometimes I'm going to learn something new, and oftentimes I do. New plants, new techniques,
mm-hmm.
Everybody brings something to the table, and the goal, of course, for me is practical application. My personal goal is not anthropology or, you know, archaeology. My personal goal is to become more self-reliant in a day-to-day way and to pass that along to others so that we're less of a, we're a positive influence in the society. We're not a drain on the society. We're actually contributing something. If there was a crisis, we'd be the saviors, not the victims. You know, that's,
oh,
that,
yeah.
That's my goal. That's what I attempt to do through the various classes that I teach and that I work with others, is so that it's amazing how a little bit, you were mentioning experience, how important that is. It's a little bit of that instills confidence, and you realize, you know, I'm not as much of a victim as they told me I was. You know,
mm-hmm.
I can actually do this. I can actually, even when it comes to medicine, one of my unpublished books, which I'll try to get published sometime soon, maybe on Kindle, I'm not sure, but it's called Integral Health. And I think it's such a hot button topic, yeah?
Yep.
That it I've had a little bit of difficulty, but it's all about my health pyramid that I my wife and I developed, and it has to do with, you know, the foundations of health are at the bottom, and then the top is the least important in our pyramid. You know, the foundations, and you go up to the very top, and the very top is actually the medical profession, healing by surgery or pills, and what's most important is basically what you do and what you think.
Absolutely.
So we address, the people say, well, that's got to do with health. You know, they think it's an alternative health book where we talk about, instead of taking a pill, taking an herb.
Mm.
And that's, I consider that part of it, but that's just slightly better than simply going to a doctor. But it's a fascinating subject, and it directly relates to survival, because let's just say you are very unhealthy and eating a poor diet and very overweight and maybe have been diabetic. You know, I mean, I feel for you, but you need to correct that by your dietary choices. I know plenty of people who died because they were overweight or,
mm-hmm.
you know, sometimes it's not a matter of something you can predict. And I know doctors don't want to say it's your fault, but, you know, I go right back to Hippocrates. Hippocrates is the original alternative health practitioner.
Thank you. I was just going to mention that, you know, what my belief is that if you need to go to a doctor, you need that pill or you need that pharmaceutical or that surgery, you know, it was already too late way before that happened. And I subscribe to the Hippocratic belief that that food is medicine.
Yeah, patient, your food should be your medicine and your medicine should be your food.
Mm-hmm.
But he also taught the value of the therapeutic value of the sun, of mm-hmm. water, you know, hot water, steam baths, breathing, exercise, diet, all of the stuff that's in vogue today. He attempted to prescribe those things in a clinical fashion to his patients. And I think we've gotten more scientific about it, although, you know, we're going in the wrong direction with what we're calling Obamacare and this kind of everybody needs the medical profession for your safety, and let's frighten the general public into, I mean, it is a major, major source of income. And I'm not denigrating doctors, although some of the drugs are totally unnecessary. Doctors need to, they do need to become more holistic. I mean, I know I have a doctor friend, and he said, you know, we start debate the relative value of garlic, among other things. And originally said, I laughed once, and I showed him this newspaper clipping where a doctor who had a newspaper column answered the question, is does garlic have any medicinal value, or is that just folklore? And my doctor friend said, oh, I agree with him, it's just folklore. And I said, you're kidding. He said, no, there's nothing to it. So then I gave him a one-inch file that I'd collected over the years
mm-hmm.
of the scientific background, and he looked at it for a week, and he gave it back to me a week later, and he said, well, no, most of this is just anecdotal. But then he had a few ones. He said, but this, some of this made me think.
Uh-huh.
And then after a few years, he started sending me articles about the proven medical value of different herbs or different other so-called alternatives. You know, he said that it isn't that it's necessarily better. It's that the public has demanded it. And
right.
by not necessarily better, I understood what he means, is that if you take an herb to eliminate a symptom, it's really no different than taking a pill, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not even necessarily safer. There's drugs that herbs that will kill you. There's herbs that if you overdo will be harmful.
Right.
So natural in quotes doesn't necessarily mean better. I have a friend who is he's an acquaintance who is a diabetic, and they started taking prickly pear cactus. Now Vioxx, I think it's Vioxx, one of these drugs was used for diabetes, and they had 1,000 or so people die, and they said, oops, so we guess we can't do that. Well, yep. with prickly pear cactus, they seem to get away with it, these drug companies. If you eat prickly pear cactus and it doesn't help you, the worst that happens is that you're eating prickly pear cactus. It doesn't kill you.
Mm.
But there are lots of people who I know I've met personally who've stopped taking insulin, and if they had, they weren't too far along with diabetes, adult onset diabetes typically. But, you know, it's the whole field is complex, but the... That is the core of survival. You know, it's your thinking, which is extremely important, and it's taking care of your health. It's not just about the knife and the fire starter in your survival kit.
Right, right.
So it's you know, if your body can't, how can you evacuate if you're thinking of emergencies? How can you know? In some cases, you will be a victim.
If you're not maintaining, your health, and you're eating at Burger King every other day, and you're taking pharmaceuticals and whatnot, you're not going to stand much of a chance if you do have to bug out into the wilderness. And I'll tell you, you're touching on a lot of probably unbeknownst to you, but you're touching on a lot of really important issues that I talk about a lot on the show. And as far as like the medical community goes. I know a lot of doctors, and I know a lot of holistic doctors and naturopathic doctors and everything. And oftentimes, what the problem is that as a culture, speaking to all of us as well as the medical community, we've all gotten brainwashed over the last 100 years or so by the pharmaceutical industry, believing the reason why the doctors immediately dismiss natural medical solutions. Is because they were never taught about it in medical school. And so the prevalent theory is, well, if it was important or if it was valid or if it wasn't quackery, then we would have learned about it in medical school. And the reason why they're not taught it in medical school is because the pharmaceutical industry has such a stranglehold over the FDA and over the at least in America, the medical the community and the medical institution, that they don't want them knowing about this stuff. But if you look at a lot of the drugs that are made by the pharmaceutical industry, a lot of them are synthetic analogs of natural compounds. They're all based on...
like aspirin.
Yeah.
you know, like aspirin. You know, aspirin is just from willow bark originally.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of them. It does come from nature originally, but no one wants to believe or accept that we have been brainwashed on a massive scale. It's disturbing, and
yeah.
Yet that does seem to be what's happened, and we bought into it, and we bought into it in a big way.
Yeah, well, it's incrementalism. You know, once the pharmaceutical industry started coming up with cures, like, you know, back in the early 20th century, I mean, all of a sudden it was a miracle. You know, the way that you talk about wonder drugs and miracle drugs and everything, and so there was this this philosophy or this belief that was implanted in our collective subconscious over, you know, a period of time that this is the way to go. Modern pharmacology is miraculous, and it can cure diseases that nothing else can. And we've just been pushed down that road gradually over a period of time. It's like a boil the frog type of situation. And I don't blame doctors at all. I've had some doctors on my show, and I know some doctors who even the naturopathic ones will tell you the same thing. It's like they were misled as well. And because I did one time mention that, you know, a lot of the doctors they're kind of bought off by the pharmaceutical industry. They're given kickbacks and they're put on salaries. To maybe they have to speak at a symposium once a year, but they're paid yearly salaries by pharmaceutical companies. And I don't mean that, nor do I now mean that all doctors in the United States are on the take or anything like that. But they are offered very compelling reasons to prescribe their drugs by the pharmaceutical companies.
I've been told that by doctors. They say they get commissions.
Yeah,
and I jokingly told my friend, "Well, you mean they're bribing you to use it?" Oh, it's not a bribe. It's,
yeah.
But that's just that's the reality of the way the world works. I'm
mm-hmm.
not even criticizing anybody because money greases things, makes things happen. But it's our health that's at stake. So
just ask yourself this question.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. I just want to get this in real quick. When was the last time any pharmaceutical company has ever found a cure for anything since polio? They're not interested in cures. They're interested in customers.
Yeah, none.
They treat the symptoms, and they get you on a treadmill where you need to keep taking the drug. That's what they're interested in doing. They're not interested in curing you. They're interested in keeping you as a returning customer.
Yeah, well, you know, unfortunately, the path of our society is such that we're going to keep the medical profession in business for a long time, unless the nature of our society changes.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, I knew Amish people when I would visit, I'd go to these survival shows they used to have. I went to some Y2K shows in Ohio, so it's been a while. But in late 90s, I was in Ohio for a while, and my family's from there. You know, and so we would visit some Amish friends of my friend in Ohio, and you know, their lifestyle is very different. So their whole sense of going to a doctor is very different. But we're very sedentary. I mean, there are people who do labor in our society, but by and large, we're very sedentary.
Mm-hmm.
We don't we wouldn't think about driving a bicycle to work. You know, or there's so many things that like I don't buy gadgets. Just I like to grind my coffee and do things by hand, squeeze my own oranges when I make juice, and I have a cheese. I don't have any electric food processors, so if the electricity goes out, I still can do whatever I need to do.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a barbecue out in the yard. I can just make a fire and cook out there. A lot of this is we've bought into this idea of convenience.
Yep.
And unfortunately, convenience has a price, and it sometimes it's not even all that convenient, and it's not even safe for us. So the whole issue of survival or self-reliance is getting simpler, and it's like Thoreau: what is your need versus your want?
Right.
You know, what are your actual needs? And we're so distracted, we can't even think straight. We can't. The great philosophers always said, "Know yourself," and that's a very profound statement, but when you've got the cell phone and the texting and the TV and the this and the that constantly blazing and the Google device that people have to always carry. You know, I have conversations with people now. Used to be I'd go to a cafe and maybe want to talk to somebody, just maybe meet somebody, and everybody's stuck in their laptop.
Yeah.
And now you have a conversation face-to-face, and they say, oh, who won that ball game? Oh, hey, I'll look it up. And then every other thing they're looking up, and I'm thinking, oh my God, they're like tethered to their Google device or whatever they call those now.
Mm-hmm.
To look this up and look that up, and actually that has a benefit, that has its place, but it just the proliferation of facts hasn't made more intelligent people. Just knowing facts doesn't make you a more valuable member of society, nor does it make you intelligent, nor does that substitute for real thinking.
Right.
And I think that's my big beef with it. Technology per se is just technology. But we grab it like children, as if it's our savior of the week, and embrace it. And often we do that to our peril. The getting simple, knowing yourself, are some of the fundamental things that Thoreau wanted to do. You know, you know who Henry David Thoreau is, of course, right?
Oh, of course, yeah. I grew up in Massachusetts, not too far from Walden Pond.
Okay,
and,
that's great.
I visited Walden Pond several times, and the thing about Thoreau is he promoted living life purposefully, living life with a purpose. When you get up in the morning, and you know, and it seems almost quaint to think about from the perspective of the time that he lived in. Mm-hmm. I think he was I think that message is a lot more important now today. Like mm-hmm. as you were talking about, we're basically you know, it's almost like a narcotic. Our culture is saturated with entertainment, and we are just addicted to gadgets and to electronics and all of these things that don't necessarily make our lives better. They don't make them more interesting, and in fact, they make us more dependent because we just drop all those things. You know, earlier on in the conversation, you were talking about, you know, the Depression era. You know, like my grandparents were from the Depression era. They stockpiled food. They had skills, and not because they were survivalists, and not because they were expecting the end of the world, but because that's what you did. And so much of our life, it wasn't really that long ago that we lived our lives with a lot more purpose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 100 years really isn't very long for an entire culture to be transformed.
It's
from
not a long time at all, yeah.
From self-sufficiency, or at least, you know, I mean, yeah, you can say, like, in the late 19th century, you know, we had the Industrial Revolution, and it wasn't like there were no machines and there weren't things that made life easier, but mm-hmm. still we lived with a lot more purpose. We didn't have electricity. For the most part, we didn't have electricity in every home. We didn't have all of these, you know, things that distract us. Like, and that's what I think it is. It's we've gotten so distracted that we forgot what life is.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, everybody needs a job, and if you have to support your family and you do something you don't particularly like, you can find ways to like it or slowly improve. But I do think that it's a good advice to regularly think, what is the purpose of life, period? And then what is the purpose of my life? And we really hope and pray that our jobs and our careers and our daily work helps to fulfill that, because I mean, to me, to survival, you know, we used to talk about survival with the friends that I work with, and we think that after an emergency, probably the gang members and the Hells Angels and the motorcycle gangs, you know, the thugs of society would probably survive quite well, but that's not what we meant by survival. We were hoping to emulate and preserve the better things in society, the things that make life worth living.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to face reality. There are bad elements, and so you have to be, you know, it's like a double thing you want to pursue. What is the meaning of life? What are the higher goals in life? But in bad times, you are going to have people who are opportunity takers. They'll steal from you, they'll kill you, they'll break into places.
Right.
So you want to be that, you want to be prepared for that kind of thing. And that's why people need to have neighborhood organizations, and that's why you support your local police and you know
mm-hmm.
and fire departments and the various organizations that we pay our taxes for. I mean, I can't tell you how many people I've met who don't vote. They believe that everybody's corrupt. You know, that there's nothing any good, and it's all a scam or whatever. And I just think that that's, you know, they might be right in some, and more often than not. But
I'll tell you, I go back and forth with that myself.
Yeah, I believe in, like, the systems that are set up that were set up from the beginning of the United States or in any country or any city. They're set up for the survival of the citizens and for the welfare of the citizens. So you don't have to go back to square one. You should understand what those square ones are, two and three and four, mm-hmm. and support them. Support them and keep them upright and keep them honest. But you know, you don't have to reinvent the wheel every single time you think about survival. So, you know, like Neighborhood Watch, that's a great tool for the neighbors to interface with the police force and, you know, learn what are the, if you live in a big city, you may feel more lonely than if you live in the country, quite frankly. But you get into a Neighborhood Watch group and you understand and you learn about what are the systems that are set up for that community if there was an emergency.
Right.
Those are things that most people don't do.
Well,
but
you
it's
know,
changing. I think it's changing little by little, and that's a good sign to get involved in these kind of organizations.
I think it's difficult for people who live in urban areas because, you know, we don't. When I was growing up, people knew who their neighbors were. People, they had interaction with them. There was something of a sense. I wouldn't say that we didn't have a community watch or anything like that, but there was more of a sense of community decades ago. And now, you know, people, they go through their lives, you know, not making eye contact. Not, you know, a lot of people don't know who their neighbors are. They wouldn't know how to approach their neighbors with a lot of these topics. Like, you know, if you're concerned about if there was a disaster, if you're concerned about an economic collapse or any kind of, you know, or even if you're, you know, the worst case scenario, the Armageddon, the end of the world, you know, it's uncomfortable for people to approach, start talking and having that dialogue with their neighbors when they really don't even spend any time to get, you know, they don't bother to get to know their neighbors in the first place, and they don't get to know the people in their communities.
Well,
and people are more insulated now than they used to.
Yeah. Well, I think in many ways, if you live in an urban area, you have your work cut out for you. My How to Survive Anywhere book, I quote an author of a book called Dark Ages Ahead, or Dark Age Ahead, by her name is Jane Jacobson. She compares a lot of things with the Roman Empire and us, and she breaks it down as kind of like reading a sociology book, but the main thing that I got from the book is that our modern urban communities are kind of rigged to fail because of two things that she points out that are almost hard to get around. But one is the automobile, which you can go anywhere anytime you want. You don't have to know your neighbors, and it sort of destroys the sense of community, especially some of these urban sprawls where you just have to go somewhere else to go shopping or whatever. And also the high housing prices. You work all the time, and you're on the road all the time. So there are a lot of issues that were almost impossible to eliminate. You just have to make other choices. And so there are factors that are clearly out there that work against our sense of community and our sense of self-reliance. So, mm-hmm. you know, you do the best you can in the situation you have.
A lot of us have substituted reality. We've substituted our reality for television, and we've substituted our sense of purpose or our intent, living with intent, as with having a job, and you know, and our lives have become, you know, and I'm sure you know this. I know this when I removed myself from, you know, the typical pattern or the, you know, the norm of, you know, getting up, going to work, coming home. And then you watch the average American, they watch, you know, 5 hours of television and they go to bed and they do the same thing. And it becomes this pattern where you get your sense of reality of, or your view of the world comes from your television, and your sense of intent comes from working a job that you hate for 8 hours a day and handing over half of your money to the government and being resentful about that and living and perpetuating that cycle over and over again.
Hey, it's not great, is it?
It's soul killing.
I know.
And people think, well, that's reality. That's what life is. And it's like, no, that's not what life is. That's not what it's supposed to be anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, anyway, that's why I do what I do. And
mm-hmm.
I write my books. I teach my classes. I write my blogs. I try to live my life that way. And not claiming I'm perfect by any means, but that's why I remember growing up feeling you know, like, this is dreadful what we're all stuck in. This whole rat race is dreadful. But there are little ways that you begin to, you know, it's like the alcoholic. You got to realize you're an alcoholic first, and then you you do this,
recognize
you do that,
there's a problem.
You start maybe growing some food and you change your diet, and it's, you know, there's many, many ways, religious or non-religious, however you go about it. But I encourage people to take action to follow their heart and to become more self-reliant and become a part of the solution to all of these problems. I mean, we have major world issues. I'm not a big proponent or believer of the world ending this December 21st, you know.
Yeah.
Studied with the Mayans, and that's who knows? You know, something could happen bad anyway.
Yeah, and as you know, you've been there. Even the Mayans today don't know what everybody's hollering about.
Oh yeah, but something could happen, right? Who knows? So the modern Mayan people are laughing about it. They say this is a celebration. This is it's a big deal. But nevertheless, let's take that off the table. You still have a lot of bad things going on in the world.
Right.
And so my feeling is that let's get real. Let's worry about what's the real things that are hidden in plain view right in our faces, you know.
My biggest fear is that on December 22nd, or let's say when 2013 rolls around and nothing happens, and everybody breathes a collective sigh of relief and they think, oh, well, now we've got nothing to worry about anymore.
Yeah, that's ridiculous, isn't
it? Yeah. Because there's about a million other things that are much more likely than some perceived Mayan prophecy or, you know, some invisible planet crashing into the Earth. And there's a whole lot of other things that can go wrong. And not that I'm a doom and gloomer either. I'm not a doomer, but, you know, we got some major changes that we need to make in our society, in our world.
Yep. And, you know, environmentally and fiscally, there's plenty of real... there's real things that are threatening our well-being and our survival that we should look at squarely and not make up problems that don't exist. You know, all the various conspiracy things you hear about all the time.
Yeah.
Well, good.
Well,
good.
Yeah. I'm awful glad that you're on the show. And one of the things that I before we go, I just wanted to point out. You know, I was brushing up on your book before the interview, and this one of the things that really struck me is that How to Survive Anywhere, it's not even really I wouldn't even call it a survival guide. It's more about just living a self-reliant life. You know, you talk about, you know, making clothes. A lot of things that you cover in this book, you really don't see in a lot of other survival books. You know, making your own clothes, making your own fiber. You know, the world is connected by fiber, I think is the name of that chapter.
Right.
And
well, yeah, I tried to cover I have water, fire, lighting, energy, health and hygiene, clothing and shelter. The world is tied together with fiber, food, tools and weapons, first aid, navigation, what is survival. But I tried to cover, break things down into the categories in the way that I teach it. And
yep.
it would apply to enhancing your life and improving the quality of your life every day. It isn't a disaster book. It's about how to be more self-reliant, and it's really the things that I do or I teach. And
yep.
it's very similar to you have the self-sufficient home book. That's where I went out and interviewed people. That really is more about the home, though, and people who became more energy efficient or grew their own food or they made their own fuel or they had compostable toilets or things like that. So a lot of my books are related themes, but they're from different approaches. But I'm glad you like the How to Survive Anywhere book. It is my most popular book, and you know, people can get it from me or get it from Amazon or wherever, and I hope I sell a couple million copies from this interview.
Yeah, and for folks who are, so do I. The information is absolutely valuable, and like I was saying, more so because of the, you know, this is kind of a guide to if we all had to go back to austere living, if we had to go back you know, let's say we had an EMP or something happened, and no more technology.
All the tools are there.
And yeah, everything you need to know really is in this book. Making bowls out of bark and fashioning your own plates and tools and everything is right there. And for those who are listening, my listeners and my readers of survivalandbeyond.net, you'll also be able to pick up How to Survive Anywhere at that site as well. So,
excellent.
So, Christopher, thanks a lot for being on the show. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Ed. I hope you invite me back soon. We could talk about my favorite plants, and we could talk about a lot of other things that we haven't even addressed.
Oh, yeah. Boy, we just didn't even scratch the surface this time. The time just flies by. Absolutely. I'd love to have you back on the show.
Wonderful. Okay, Ed. Thank you very much. Good night.
Take care.
And once again, that'll do it for this installment of Survival and Beyond, and I really enjoyed having Christopher Nierjesh on the show, and glad you folks are all listening. And don't forget to check out survivalandbeyond.net. We've got all kinds of free survival guides, videos, and all the news that you won't get from the mainstream disinformation machine. So don't forget to check that out at survivalandbeyond.net. And hey, while you're at it, why don't you swing by Facebook and like our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/survivalandbeyond. And until next week, as usual, keep your head up and keep on living free. And hey, don't take any crap from anybody.